Good day and welcome to the 10th presentation by Drinker Biddle of Inside the Beltway Call. Today's speakers will be Fred Riche and Brad Campbell. Now, I would like to turn the call over to Mr. Fred Riche. Please go ahead, sir.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. And hello, everybody. Welcome to the program. Just as a matter of introduction, I'm the chair of the Financial Services ERISA team at Drinker Biddle, and what that means is that my focus is on the regulation of retirement plans, particularly from a Title I fiduciary perspective, and the regulation on of service providers to retirement plans, both as fiduciaries and non-fiduciaries. And so that gives you a little context to understand my comments. More importantly, though, with me from our Washington, D.C. office is Brad Campbell. Brad was the Assistant Secretary for the Employee Benefits Security Administration during the prior administration. In other words, he held Phyllis Borzy's position before Phyllis Borzy did. And the significance of that is that he's been a part of the regulation-making process, in fact, signed off on several major pieces of guidance and regulations. So Brad also brings a very distinct perspective of inside the Beltway to our Beltway program. So that you all know, this session is being recorded, as all of them have been. And the recording will be available within a few days. So if you want to refer some of your compatriots to the program to listen to it, or if you would like to revisit part of it, wait for a few days and it'll be posted at www.drinkerbiddle.com. So that's the name of the law firm. Should be easy enough to remember. And then you need to look under the Resources tab. In other words, look for where it says Resources and click on it, and it'll take you right to the recording. To make this even easier on you, though, everybody who registered for this program will be receiving an email once the recording is loaded on our website. So you get an email with a link in it, just in case you want to go back to it or refer someone to it. It's my pleasure now to introduce Jim Dolan from Matt Tixis. And I want to thank Jim, and I want to thank Matt Tixis, because they're the ones that are sponsoring this program so that Brad and I can bring it to you. And in essence, they're making it available to you. Jim, thank you very much for helping us out on this.
Fred, it's certainly my pleasure. I appreciate the opportunity, and we appreciate the partnership. It's been a great year. These calls have been very insightful and helpful, so we're glad to continue to do them. For those of you who aren't familiar with Natixis Global Asset Management, our mission is to help people lead better financial lives. We do this through a process called durable portfolio construction. We provide access to over 20 specialized investment managers. We'd invite you to take a look at our website, natixisfunds.com, to learn more about our investment options as well as our focus on retirement. I would like to take a moment before I hand it over to Brad and just thank everyone for calling in today and taking the time to listen to the call. And I would like to personally thank Liz Jutila for all of her help this year in putting these calls together. It certainly has been very insightful and helpful for our callers, so I'm grateful to be a part of this. So I think we're going to start off today by discussing the retirement plan implications of the recent congressional elections. And Brad, if you'd like to start us off there, that'd be wonderful.
Great. Well, thank Jim. Thank you, Jim, and thank you, Fred. And more importantly, thanks again to all of you for taking the time to join us. We've been, you know, very humbled by your response, and we appreciate it. So the first question that a lot of folks in this space have been having since the elections, where the Republicans took over control of the House and Senate, is, you know, what does this all mean? There are some issues where obviously that change in control is going to mean a major shift in policy. And a major shift in direction by the Congress. And one of the questions that people have is, you know, is retirement policy one of those areas? And fortunately or unfortunately, I think the answer is probably not. I think it's not, this isn't one of the areas where there's the type of large disagreement that the change in control of Congress makes a really significant difference. Although I think it does make a difference in certain ways. One, it makes a difference in the tone when we start getting into comprehensive tax reform debates. I think it does make a difference in the tone of the hearings and what faults they see in the system and what problems they're trying to solve. You know, we've seen an awful lot of interest in some of the Senate hearings that have been coming up in the last year while the Democrats were running the Senate, focusing on the what they perceive to be the tax abuses of wealthy people using IRAs and other, you know, those types of plans. And I think for most of us looking at that system, we're really less concerned that there might be a few people who, you know, got lucky and have IRAs with high balances, as opposed to the fact that most people aren't saving enough for retirement, and that's really the area we ought to focus on. But I think when you start seeing the House and Senate debating comprehensive tax reform, unfortunately, both Republicans and Democrats are likely to want to shake some revenue out of our retirement plan system and try and make changes to how plans and qualified plans are taxed in a way that generates some revenue to be used for other purposes. While I think Republicans and Democrats disagree on what those other purposes are, they both sort of have that common goal. So I think that's an area, regardless of who won, we have to really be paying attention to going forward. The one big area where there could be a material difference is actually in the DOL fiduciary regulation. The House passed last year a bill with 30 Democrats supporting it, which was actually a pretty decent showing of bipartisanship, that said the Labor Department should not proceed forward with its fiduciary rule until the SEC had proceeded with its harmonization of the standards under the securities laws. And that was a bill that passed the House, but of course wasn't taken up by the Senate. In the new Congress, where you have a Republican House and a Republican Senate, Republican-controlled Senate, we may well see a bill like that be able to proceed. And so, as we'll discuss a little later on with the regulatory agenda at the agencies, when DOL comes out with its re-proposal, and depending on what's in it and how controversial it is, we may actually see Congress taking some direct action to address this regulation. And that's something that probably would not have been possible were it not for a change in control. And that's kind of a quick high-level summary of where we are there. But again, I don't think it's probably an earth-shaking change.
Let me ask you a couple of questions about that. Since it seems that President Obama won't be able to get his agenda through Congress now, do you think that one of the effects of that is that he'll try to advance his agenda more through the regulatory and administrative process? I mean, I think we've already seen one example of that with the immigration announcement from the White House. Do you see that possibly moving over into the retirement plan area as well?
Well, you know, I think we've actually seen DOL having no shortage of ideas of things they wanted to move through the regulatory process anyway, but I certainly think that they will continue to do that. Now, how many sort of new projects and things does that translate into? You know, I suspect that DOL has enough on its agenda right now, especially, as we'll discuss later, the newly put together agenda, which has some new items on it, that probably we've seen most of what there is to see from the Labor Department. But I think in general, yes, the President is certainly likely to be moving more through the regulatory process, especially here in the last 2 years of his administration, because those are issues they can directly control. And the reality is that the regulatory process gives a tremendous amount of discretion to the agencies. If the agencies are careful and if they follow, you know, dot the I's and cross the T's of the regulatory process, the courts won't really question the determinations they make unless they're just sort of unreasonable, that you couldn't get there from reading the law to the position the agency took. If the agency's taken a position that's sustainable as a reasonable interpretation of the law, and if they dotted the I's and crossed the T's, they can pretty much finish that regulation and put it out there without too much fear of it being challenged. So there's a lot of discretionary authority there that agencies can use if they're careful about how they do it. But with that, maybe we should point out that we did just, you know, we put out the agenda on this call here before, you know, a month back or so, whatever it was. In the intervening time, right before Thanksgiving, the administration put out its newly updated fall regulatory agenda. And so, Fred, maybe this would be a good time for us to start walking through what's on there, the new dates, and also the new items that appeared.
Sure. For those of you who don't follow these things as wonks as we do, the Department of Labor issued its fall 2014 regulatory agenda just a couple of weeks ago, but as Brad mentioned, after we'd sent out the notice of the program. So, but we don't want to let our pre-printed notice override what's really important in the regulatory world and what we believe to be is really important to you all. So we're gonna deal with that right now. And I'm going to walk through them, introduce each subject, make one or two comments, and then turn it over to Brad for an insider's perspective, and then we'll go back and forth a little bit on what we think it means. Brad, the first one was that the DOL said that with regard to the standards for brokerage windows, that is, the previous regulatory or guidance project they had about whether or not the standards, we needed to have a better explanation or more fiduciary standards for brokerage windows. The Department of Labor had issued an RFI, a request for information, and then the comment period ended on November 19th, just a few weeks ago. Why don't you pick up and talk a little bit about the history of this, how we got to where we are on November 19th, and then what you think is going to happen after November 19th, even though there's nothing on the regulatory agenda post-November 19th.
Yeah, so to be clear, the regulatory agenda they just put out kept this as an item but didn't list what the next step would be. And that's probably because, as Fred was saying, the RFI comment period just ended right about the time the new agenda came out. And they really need to go through the comments to decide what their next steps are. Because I think in some ways, with respect to the RFI, let's take a step back and look at the history. It seems like DOL really became concerned about brokerage window issues back in 2012 when we were doing the participant disclosure, the 404A5 regulation, and DOL put out some field assistance bulletin with Q&As in it, and one of them suggested that there, at least as an enforcement policy of DOL, that there might be an obligation of the plan sponsor to treat as if they were DIAs, designated investment alternatives that had been selected by the plan, things that participants bought through the brokerage window if enough participants bought the same thing. So as an example, if five or more participants invested in the same security on the other side of the window, potentially the plan might have to treat that as if the plan had designated that security as a core menu item. That was, of course, pretty controversial. DOL withdrew from that position and went back to its current position about what you need to disclose about brokerage windows, which really is that they exist, how they work, what the costs are for using them, et cetera. But DOL put down a marker at that time saying, look, we're still concerned that people are using brokerage windows to avoid disclosure of investment information and in other ways, and we're going to talk to the regulated community and decide what our next steps are. And so the RFI that they put out earlier this year was that sort of next step coming. And the questions DOL asked in that RFI were extraordinarily broad. They really covered the entire waterfront of issues, not just, you know, who's using these windows, when are they found, which participants, how much of their accounts are they allocating, but also a host of fiduciary issues. You know, how did you select the service provider? How did you decide what's on the other side of the window? Just a whole bunch of, 39 questions in particular, but covering just the whole waterfront of issues, which suggests the DOL is taking a much broader review of brokerage windows in plans and what it all means. And so while the agenda doesn't tell us what their next step is, and while presumably specifically what their next step will be, is going to be determined in part by their review of the comments, we think it's quite likely that sometime next year we'll probably start seeing guidance, would be my guess, come out on brokerage windows and certain discrete issues there, in part because I think it's going to be very difficult for them to begin a new regulatory project and do an actual regulation, given the fact that there's only about 2 years left in this administration to do it, but also because the guidance, they could issue guidance that would have your useful effect without having to go through a full bore review process. And it could be, for example, the way they did on target date funds. They issued guidance saying, here are the factors you should be looking at in selecting a target date fund. That wasn't guidance that went through a regulation, went through a regulatory process. It wasn't under excessive review. Yet it's something that all of us look to and are paying attention to. So DOL, I think, is likely to do something like that with respect to brokerage windows, but which issues they pick out to really work on is something that we're going to have to wait and see, and how broad they want to be is something we're going to have to wait and see, and I think in part will be determined by what they learned from the RFI.
So, Brad, you're distinguishing between regulations on the one hand and guidance on the other. Would guidance include like advisory opinions, information letters, tips to fiduciaries, that and maybe more?
Yeah, it could, and that's kind of an interesting thing. You know, the DOL has, in effect, there's sort of a hierarchy of guidance in terms of what validity it has as an agency statement. And actually, for example, that target date fund guidance really was the lowest level. I mean, in legal terms, it was just a press release rather than an advisory opinion, for example, which at least has effect to the party it's issued to. A field assistance bulletin is kind of in between. It's a little more formalized because it's technically an internal memo from one part of EBSA to another, saying, here's how we, for example, from interpretations to enforcement, saying, hey, here's how we in interpretations want you in enforcement to look at this issue. So they have kind of a range of options and guidance that they could do relatively quickly and easily, which for all of us in the regulated community have value and effect because it's a statement of agency position. But actually, in purely legal terms, it's probably not dispositive of any particular action. So they have a lot of options available to them and how they wanted to proceed.
Yeah, Brad, as I look at what the Department of Labor is doing on the comments that have been filed, it seems to me the tension, that there are two points of tension. The first is that, plan sponsors by and large, I believe, have felt that brokerage windows or brokerage accounts for participants who invested in them were sort of a personal investment portfolio, and that the plan sponsor had no responsibility at all. So the first point of tension would be, is there a duty to prudently select and monitor the provider of brokerage accounts, the broker-dealer, even though it's a participant decision? And my sense is it's almost inevitable that the Department of Labor will come out and say, yes, there is a fiduciary duty to prudently select and monitor the provider of brokerage accounts and their fees and expenses and services, because that duty exists for every service provider to a plan. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I do, and I think that's where the department would have to come out, because I don't see any reason why you would say that it's different from hiring any other service provider, and especially since you're hiring a service provider who's charging participants directly for, you know, for services that are being provided. Yeah, so I think that's absolutely right. And I also think that what I think will be more interesting, because let me say, first of all, I agree with you. I think DOL will probably say something about that, and I think what you said is where they'll come out. I think there's some other questions which could be kind of more interesting and more challenging for DOL to weigh in on. For example, what duty, if any, exists for determining what investment options are available through the window, and what the fiduciary considerations of that question might be. Because I think that's kind of one could argue that that's part and parcel of selecting the service provider, but there are a lot of considerations there that could affect participants as well as the plan.
Yeah, you know, that raises the interesting issue that when this, if that happens and if it's highly publicized, how are plan committees, plan fiduciaries going to feel about their ability to prudently select and monitor broker-dealers? Maybe if there's just one provider, one broker-dealer associated with a record keeper, maybe they would feel okay about that, on the, you know, thinking that it's been vetted by the record keeper, whether it's true or not, but believing that. But I think more problematic would be that sort of a law firm scenario that you often see, where for a law firm or a medical group or other professional organization, each partner, therefore each participant, can select their own broker-dealer. And how will plan fiduciaries feel about prudently selecting and monitoring 5 or 10 different broker-dealers, 15 or 20 different broker-dealers? Are they really going to engage in that process? How's the fiduciary advisor or the non-fiduciary consultant to the plan going to assist them in that process? I can see where it may create a little bit of turmoil there. And then I get you, so you got the single provider, multiple providers of brokerage accounts, and then you get to the third scenario that we frequently see, which is where a small plan sets up each participant in a brokerage account, probably all with the same broker-dealer, but there is no core lineup of mutual fund investments. Each person is just in their own brokerage account, and that's all that's offered. What do you think about that scenario and the potential for guidance there, Brad?
Well, I think that's an issue DOL likely will tackle. Back in 2012 when they were doing the field assistance bulletins on participant disclosures and when DOL decided not to fight this fight then but to look at it later, that was one of the things they specifically highlighted in their statement was we're very concerned that when you have these brokerage window-only plan designs, that there's no investment information actually being given to participants and that therefore it's avoiding the disclosure entirely. And they actually raised sort of an affirmative statement, but they raised the question of whether that plan design was even potentially per se imprudent. I mean, DOL got very concerned about that particular design. And in part it's because if you remember what the participant disclosure regulation was all about, it was DOL creating a new fiduciary obligation for the plan administrator, saying, well, if you're going to put the duty on participants to select their own investments, then there has to be a corresponding duty on the plan to give them the basic information with which to select those investments. And so when you have this brokerage window only design where no investment information is being given, it made DOL very unhappy. And I suspect that's something they might well address when they do come out with guidance.
Yeah, I have the same thought. They're at least going to say something about it. Well, let's move on. The next item was what the DOL calls pension benefit statements, but what I think all of us really think about as the projection of lifetime income on participant quarterly statements. That's been a long and convoluted process. There was an advance notice of proposed rulemaking back in May of 2013, and then there was a comment period. The comment period ended in August of 2013. It's been quiet for a while, but in the new fall agenda, the Department of Labor said they plan to issue a proposed regulation in July of 2015, so 7 or 8 months from now. What are your thoughts on that, Brad?
Yeah, well, that was actually a delay. They was supposed to come out here in January, and so they moved it back to July. But this is an issue where I think what DOL's trying to do, sort of the concept behind it, makes a lot of sense. I mean, the concept behind this regulation is that when you tell a participant you've got $180,000 in your account, that doesn't really mean anything to anybody. It just sounds like a lot of money. But if you say you've got $300 a month in income, or $200 a month in income, or whatever it is, that actually is a figure that makes sense to people, and they can kind of instinctively wrap their heads around it and see if they're on the right path or the wrong path. Yeah, I kind of think of it as analogous to that little box on your credit card statements that says if you make the minimum payments, you'll never be debt-free and you'll owe $100 billion. But if you only pay $50 more a month, you can be out of this in 3 years. The idea is to help you understand how you can do that a little better. I think something similar in pension benefit statements would help. And so DOL seems to be considering mandating that at least one of the quarterly benefit statements have this projection of income. But how you actually do it, I think, is supremely important. And that's where it's going to be very interesting to see what DOL has selected for the actual proposal. You pointed out that they did an ANPRM, this advance notice, or sort of a pre-rule process for this regulation. That's pretty unusual. DOL normally doesn't do that. But I think the reason they did it on this one is in part because the technical issues here are actually pretty hard. And getting it right is something that they're very concerned about. So they've taken this we get multiple rounds at making comments on this as a result of their concern that they answer some of these questions properly. So just a couple of these threshold questions. Are you making this projection based on somebody with their current account balance as if they're retiring today, or are you projecting that balance forward to their likely retirement date and then making a projection? And I think that has a potentially significant effect. If you tell a 25-year-old with a small balance that they're going to get $20 a month in retirement income, that could potentially disincent them from staying in the plan. Alternatively, though, if you have to roll that same balance forward 40 years, you're making an awful lot of assumptions to get from A to B. And so where DOL comes out on some of these questions is, I think, going to have a lot of impact on how useful this is, what unintended effects there might be. I kind of think of this as a sleeper regulation. I don't think it's gotten the attention it deserves, because I think how they do this could really matter in how participants perceive the value of the plan and how advisors interact with the plan.
Now, I agree. I actually think that potentially this has the greatest impact of any of the things we're going to talk about today. Not so much on, you know, around the periphery, around the edges, but in terms of real fundamental change in how participants see their money in the 401k plan or a 403b plan as retirement income rather than as an amount of debt. Conceptually, it's a great idea. The devil's in the details, though. But the good thing about it, even there, is that participants will get an updated statement every year. So it's not going to create, it won't be misleading in the sense that they get a statement today and 40 years from now we see whether it turns out to be true or not. Every year along the way it gets updated. So at least it'll be directionally correct. And even if they get all the assumptions right, even if they get everything about it right, it's bound to be wrong, just like the assumptions in a defined benefit plan are wrong. The importance is that it be updated periodically and that they be given information to understand that, you know, changes in the market, changes in interest rates and other things could impact the accuracy of the statement. But just to have some, just to basically change the concept from accumulation of wealth to accumulation of income, and then how much, you know, and then the participant can make a decision about whether or not they're going to have enough to live on in retirement. And those are complicated calculations, as Brad suggested. They're actuarial calculations, not something to easy for a person to easily do on their own. There are a number of sophisticated assumptions about investment returns, future inflation, estimated retirement date. I mean, imponderables in many ways, but at least we'll get it up and get it going. Okay, Brad, let's turn to the next big one. What the Department of Labor calls the conflict of interest rule, what all of us think of as the expansion of the definition of fiduciary advice. In the fall agenda, the one just issued, the Department of Labor said they will issue the proposed regulation in January of next year, a mere month away. And if we think about that, you know, this is a regulation that was withdrawn previously. They've taken it back in. There's been a lot of consultation and meetings and lobbying even going on. And now, in theory, they've reworked it together with there's the proposed regulation itself. There's a set of prohibited transaction exemptions that will be concurrently proposed. And there is the economic justification. So there's going to be three parts to the package that get issued. Targeted date, January of next year. Brad, what do you think about the targeted date, and what do you think that this thing is going to look like when we do get it?
Well, you know, it was really interesting to see that, because every other regulation on the agenda got delayed to a further date, you know, from January to July or to September or whatever it might be, except this one. It stayed in January. But if you look at the website that the Office of Management and Budget puts out, which shows you when an agency has sent a regulation over for final approval before it's published, as of yesterday at least, that had not yet happened with this rule. So we have a rule that is supposed to come out in a month, but it's not yet been sent to the White House for review, at least officially. And that review process normally takes at least 90 days. So that suggests that there's a couple of alternatives here. One is that they just didn't want to suggest that they were not giving it a priority and therefore kept the date, figuring even if they missed it by a little bit, that's fine. Or alternatively, they've been doing an awful lot of backroom pre-clearance and a lot of coordination on the back end so that when this does go to OMB, it actually goes through very quickly. That would be unusual, but if they really have been doing a lot of behind-the-scenes pre-clearance, it is theoretically possible. Which of those is the case, we don't know. But I thought that was a very interesting factor to look at its timing, given that it hasn't even officially, at least, gone to the White House for review. In terms of what will be in it, Obviously, we're all speculating about that. I think of it as kind of having three primary components. One is this question of what makes you a fiduciary investment advisor to a plan or a participant. And my presumption is that they're going to continue to maintain a pretty broad expansion of that definition. And I think they'll try to mitigate the effects of that broad expansion, some of the issues that came to cause them to pull this regulation back in 2011, through, as you mentioned, some of the privileged transaction exemptions. Class exemptions that will come with it. So, for example, one they've said that they're going to do is to allow broker-dealers to engage in principal transactions even if they're a fiduciary, which right now they couldn't do if they were a fiduciary. So they would put out a privileged transaction class exemption to allow that to occur under certain conditions. What those conditions are, et cetera, we won't know until we see the published rule. The second big area is having the privileged transaction rules use this definition of fiduciary with respect to IRA accounts, so that if you're an IRA provider giving advice to an IRA holder, you'd have to be paid as if you're a fiduciary. And that was also very controversial, but DOL has consistently said they want to keep that there because they believe that the IRA marketplace, now I'm paraphrasing, I don't know if they've said it quite this way, but the reason they want to do that is they fundamentally don't believe the IRA marketplace is well regulated and is sufficiently protective. They kind of view it as all this money for ERISA plans ends up in IRAs, and they go from this well-protected area to this not-so-well-protected area, and DOL's trying to address it that way. The third part is rollover solicitations. And in 2010, in the original proposal, DOL asked the question as to whether their current position on rollovers was sufficiently protective of workers. And I think in this new regulation, the new proposal, they'll probably answer that question with a regulatory proposal, and they'll probably say, no, our current position isn't sufficiently protective, and therefore we need to make it more protective. And just briefly, their current position is that if you're not a fiduciary to the plan, so either you're a non-fiduciary service provider or you're unaffiliated with this plan, that you can solicit rollovers and it's not really subject to ERISA. It's basically not an ERISA issue when you do that. The flip side of that is if you are a fiduciary to the plan, DOL has said that it may be, they haven't said it absolutely is, but it may be a prohibited transaction for you to solicit rollovers. So that's really problems at both ends. One question is, do we know what's going on with people who are cold calling participants to sell them IRA products? And the other end is, but we've got a situation where an advisor who's well known to the plan and trusted by everyone and who's gone through the fiduciary review by the plan for a number of years may not be able to take a rollover from someone who seeks them out. So there's kind of problems at both ends. If I were to guess, I think what DOL will do, and let me be clear, this is a guess because we don't yet know, what I think DOL will do is take the position that any advice or any solicitation for a rollover is itself fiduciary advice. And I think that they would be likely to do that because that would give them jurisdiction over the entire rollover process. And I think that that would be an approach that would fit with their concerns, although it would also be an extremely controversial position for them to take.
No, Brad, I really see all of this exactly the same way as you do. I mean, I think you laid it out chapter and verse just how it will probably come out. And when I think Phyllis Borges has been quoted as saying that IRAs are the wild, wild west of retirement.
Was Tim Hauser, actually.
Okay, well, Tim, let's attribute it to President Obama while we're at it. But I've heard it several places, and I do think that there's a tremendous concern about it. As a result, when this regulatory package, this proposed package, comes out, the first two things I'm going to look at are what it said. Does it grant an exemption for IRAs, for advice to investments in IRAs? And if so, how broad is it? What are the conditions or strings that are attached? And then secondly, I'm going to look at the language about capturing rollovers from retirement plans into IRAs. I think those two things will indicate how big a fight there's going to be between the financial services sector and the Department of Labor and working this out. I would also point out that that FINRA and the SEC have become very active in looking at role of IRAs, from plans to IRAs. In fact, both FINRA and the SEC had that on their 2014 examination priority list. And recently, the SEC has said they're going to put it on their 2015 examination priority list. So that means both broker-dealers and RIAs are going to be examined based on their practices and capturing rollovers. Brad, let's skip a couple.
And actually, if we could just jump back to that for 1 second, because I think this is an interesting spin on it. If DOL does take the position that all rollover solicitations are fiduciary in nature, what does that do to FINRA? It seems to me that it kind of blows FINRA's new suitability standards out of the water, because who cares whether this meets the suitability standards if it's now a matter of ERISA fiduciary duty. And I kind of wonder to what extent there's some potential for jurisdictional infighting with the government on this position.
Well, you know, they may actually harmonize in the sense that they may, that what FINRA has laid out as the suitability standard, to me, looks very much like a fiduciary standard. And if both agencies are applying the same standards, I one way to look at that is it makes it easier rather than worse. Also, FINRA applies to one-person plans that are regulated under the Internal Revenue Code but not under ERISA, and FINRA applies to government plans that would be regulated, not regulated by ERISA. So the FINRA guidance is somewhat broader than the ERISA, whatever the ERISA guidance ends up being. So, but I don't know. I'm beginning to see the agencies coming together and harmonizing their guidance, but that the convergence is more towards the DOL position and less towards what historically might have been the SEC position, that disclosure is enough. But I agree. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see if they harmonize, it might not be as much of a problem. And looking at the criteria that FINRA has laid down, it looks awfully close to a fiduciary standard, even though the enforcement mechanism is somewhat different.
Yeah. Well, what I'd really like to see DOL do is put out a prohibited transaction class exemption dealing with rollovers so that we would have a uniform set of conditions, and then we wouldn't have this problem for the fiduciary advisor who's now operating a gray area if they decide to accept rollovers, whether they're soliciting them or whether they're coming to them of their own accord.
Wow, that's a great idea, Brad. Can you have that application over to them in a couple of days? Yeah, we wish, huh? Well, let's move on to one more, and then we'll go to other parts of the program, to the previously scripted agenda. As I look at the rest of the items that were on the DOL's regulatory agenda for the Employee Benefits Security Administration, Brad, the remaining important one is the idea of a guide or a similar requirement for 408B2 disclosures. There already is a proposed regulation. It was issued in March of this year. The comment period ended in June of this year. And the Department of Labor is predicting that the final regulation on this will be issued in September of 2015. Brad, why don't you walk us back through a little bit of the history on that and then tell us what you think is going to happen.
Yeah, so in March, DOL put out a proposed rule requiring this guide disclosure, and the idea behind it was that the 408B2s that particularly smaller plan fiduciaries are getting are just too difficult for them to understand. And so DOL was trying to lay out a standard where if your disclosure, your 408B2 disclosure, is either too long, although in the regulation they didn't define how long too long is, they asked for comment on how long too long would be, or if it's in multiple documents, then that would trigger this new requirement to have a separate document that would be, in effect, a table of contents to all of the fees in the other documents. And they affirmatively did not want this guide to be a summary. I personally question how useful that structure is to helping fiduciaries figure out the disclosures if they already are having trouble, but DOL didn't want to do a summary, I believe because they're concerned that important information might not be included. It'd be potentially too easy to hide some of the data. Whatever the reasons might be, they wanted to take this guide approach. And a lot of comments came in were sort of critical of obviously, a number of comments came in supporting the idea, but there were an awful lot of comments critical of how it would be executed. So, for example, not knowing how long too long is, but that also raises the question of how are you defining too long? You know, if too long is page numbers, let's say, you know, the limit is 20 pages, what's to prevent people from playing with the margins and the fonts and, you know, trying to squeeze something down to 20 pages? Does that mean DOL is going to have to define what a page is and start specifying fonts or, you know, size or words per page or whatever it might be? It seems to raise a whole lot of practical problems for that type of concept. Similarly, where the guide is referencing you to a particular, you know, place, sort of the locator for that table of contents marker, how precise does it have to be? Is it by page number? Is it by section? Or is it by, you know, subsection, you know, 43A2i kind of thing? And so there are a lot of practical questions about how DOL did this. Another one, of course, is cost. So if you have to, as the service provider, produce a guide that shows where every 12B1 fee is in every mutual fund on the platform, and those, of course, aren't themselves standardized, how are you going to do that, and how expensive is it going to be to pull all those data points out and identify them properly? So there are a lot of concerns about this regulation, about how DOL was approaching it. DOL also simultaneously has been doing some small group focus groups with small plan fiduciaries to show them different disclosure styles and get input from them about which ones make the most sense, which ones are easier or harder to read. And I think when you combine the fact that there's new information that DOL's been receiving from these, you know, small fiduciary focus groups, along with the fact that a lot of people said that and I think this is a valid criticism. A lot of people said that the initial proposal, because it didn't specify how long too long was, for example, and the several other areas where they didn't have a concrete proposal so much as an idea they were asking for input on, a lot of people questioned whether under the Administrative Procedure Act you could actually go to a final rule on some of those, or whether an additional proposal might be required as part of the regulatory process. So while DOL has set out September as the date for the final rule, I think it's likely we're going to see some action between now and then where they either offer a partial reproposal or new elements to it as additional proposals. I think there's more to come on this because I think DOL got a lot of feedback that they're going to have to address between now and then, and I think some of it will involve some new ideas.
You know, Brad, I agree with the way you summarized, but I just to point out one thing to everybody. The you know, if the industry is saying, gee, it's really hard to go through and find the 12B1 fees in every prospectus and then have a table of contents that points to the plan sponsor exactly where to go and look for that, and you know, similarly for subtransfer agency fees or revenue sharing or other things. That also means it'd be really hard for plan sponsors to do that. You know, on the one hand, you've got several hundred industry participants who would need to do it. On the other hand, you have a few hundred thousand plan fiduciaries that would need to do it one by one. And it's just a conundrum to me. How do we take these complicated documents and lengthy printed documents like prospectuses and other documents that the industry is saying it's too hard to go through them and identify all those places, when that also means that it's really hard for plan sponsors to go through them and identify all those places, and probably even more time-consuming since the documents are alien to them and the language is alien to them. So, you know, I don't think there's a good answer either place. I'm not saying it's easier on the industry and harder on plan sponsors. I'm really saying it's hard on both. But it seems like we need some kind of a solution because I've seen some disclosures that would take hours and hours for plan sponsors to go through and figure out if they could figure them out at all. My thinking is that it might be good for the Department of Labor, rather than adding additional regulation, to start a robust enforcement project and go out and enforce the current regulation and go after the people who made unclear disclosures or who left things out of their disclosures and approach this from an enforcement perspective rather than a regulatory perspective. And maybe that in and of itself would improve the quality of the disclosures. Having said that, if we do get a regulation, there are four primary categories of service providers. There are RIAs, and typically their documents are not lengthy or multiple. Typically they make their disclosures for 408B2 purposes on a single document, so they wouldn't be impacted by it. There are third-party administrators. Similarly, they wouldn't be impacted by it. The remaining two categories are record keepers and broker-dealers, both of whom need to rely on multiple documents. Those are the two categories that would be impacted by this 408B2 guide. And I know from talking with them, it would be very expensive and very time-consuming to do it. So I'm at a loss as to where the answer is, but I agree with the department that there's a problem.
Well, I just think this guide approach, is table of contents approach, is fundamentally not that helpful. I think if they really wanted to help small fiduciaries understand this, they ought to require a good summary. And we can all debate over exactly what needs to be in that summary, but I think a summary is going to get a lot more traction than a 40-page long table of contents that references 900 specific points in documents.
Yeah, what I would prefer, frankly, if we're going to go that route, in addition to that, would be at the end of each year, each service provider, within 90 days after the end of the year or something, send to the plan fiduciaries exact dollar amount that they collected from the plan during the preceding year. I'm not real keen on percentage disclosures. I think dollar amount disclosures would be much more impactful. And you can't really do dollar amount until after the end of the year. So that to me would be a great way to go. But I think it would be very expensive and difficult because I don't think the systems are in place to do that. But I think in the future we could see something more like that. If this 408B2 project, not the current regulation, but the whole thing dating back to 2012, doesn't really prove to have impact. Having said that, though, there's a lot of data that there's a pressure on fees because of a combination of things being done, the litigation for 408B2 and so on. So it's hard to say it's not working. Maybe we're not working in the right way because there's not enough discussion about value and there's too much discussion about cost. But at least at some level it's having an impact. Hey, let's move on to the next one.
If before we move on, can we mention one more regulation I think is worth pointing out? Because this was a brand new one that DOL put on this new regulatory agenda of a couple weeks ago. And that's a complete revision of the Form 5500. And I think this is one where we're going to have to wait and see what they're proposing. But of course, no one's ever excited to talk about the Form 5500, for good reason. I mean, if there's a most boring part of ERISA, it's probably the 5500. But DOL, Treasury, and PBGC staff have apparently been working kind of behind the scenes for over a year to really revamp the form, probably with an eye towards collecting a lot more fee data, kind of beyond harmonizing the Schedule C with 408B2, but probably collecting a lot more data about fees and about investments. And I think one of the big questions will be how much more do they require on a short form filer, the 100 and fewer participants, than they have in the past. But I think this is one where there's going to be a lot of interesting things to talk about when we see what they're actually looking to propose. And that's scheduled for July.
Okay. Good. I'm going to talk. We'll cover a couple of topics very quickly, and then we'll go to Q&A. The first is the Supreme Court has accepted the case of Tibble versus Edison International. And if you all recall that case, it was one where the allegations were that the plan should have had institutional share classes because it had multiple billions of dollars in it rather than retail. The title. The articles that are written about the case have what I think are misleading titles. For example, one says U.S. Supreme Court to decide ERISA statute of limitations case. Another one says Supreme Court decision on 401k fee case could have a domino effect. But what those articles don't really make clear, and certainly the titles don't make clear, is that the issue before the Supreme Court is whether there is a discrete duty to monitor investments. But to explain that, and there were two of the mutual funds that the trial court held should have been institutional rather than retail share classes, and damages were assessed against the fiduciaries for those. But there were others that were institutional that had been selected more than 6 years before the lawsuit was filed, and there's a 6-year ERISA statute of limitations. The trial court and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, consistent with some other courts of appeals, ruled that, well, once 6 years has gone by from when an investment was selected, there's no duty, no continuing duty to monitor. That is, the duty to monitor doesn't start that statute all over again. So once 6 years have gone by, the fiduciaries are safe from any claims against that fund. Now, the Ninth Circuit did say, well, you know, maybe under some changed circumstances, you would have to go back and revisit the investment. But essentially the ruling is, after 6 years, you don't have to monitor the investments anymore because monitoring is not a separate legal responsibility from the original duty to select, and therefore the statute of limitations runs from the initial selection. Well, obviously, this creates some tension between the plan sponsor community, which wants to have that protection, and the advisor community, which for years has been preaching that there's a duty to monitor. And this it either eliminates or substantially reduces the duty to monitor the way that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals and some other courts of appeals have ruled. Now, so the question before the Supreme Court is not really a statute of limitations question. The question is there an independent duty to monitor that has its own 6-year statute of limitations such that every year the failure to monitor can be sued on at any point in the next 6 years? I say watch this case very carefully because it could diminish the value of advisors if the Supreme Court says, nope, no duty. The duty to monitor is not separate from the original duty to select. On the other hand, watch it very closely because if it says there's an ongoing duty to monitor which has its own separate legal identity and that the statute of limitations runs on that independent of the original selection, then that would effectively publicize the importance of monitoring and would enhance the value of advisors. And then there's that, of course, that in-between position where you don't generally have a duty to monitor, or the duty to monitor is not generally a separate duty, but on occasions it can be, and then it depends on what the Supreme Court says those occasions are. So hold on to your seats, watch that case, it's going to be significant. Let me skip over one and come back in a minute to the guaranteed benefits and targeted funds. Let me talk very quickly about the money market reforms. And essentially, in 2016, so a while away, and you'll be reading and hearing a lot more about this, you're going to have to advise. If you're a plan sponsor, you're going to have to make a decision. If you're an advisor, you're going to have to advise based on the selection of the money market funds for plans. So there's going to be a lot more focus on money market funds beginning at that point in time. And that's because the money market reform rules proposed, or are now final, from the Securities and Exchange Commission, say that if you have an institutional fund, it will float. The value will float. And so plan sponsors and advisors are going to have to decide, does that matter? Will it be upsetting to participants that one day the value is 0.9994 and the next day the value is 1001? And so on. If you don't want it to float, you could get out of an institutional mutual fund and go to a retail mutual fund. The problem with retail mutual funds under those rules is that they're going to have gateways and redemption fees. Gateway meaning that for limited periods of time, access may be blocked if we have another meltdown like we did in 2008, or if not blocked, then a redemption fee of up to 2% can be imposed to an employee who wants to take their money out. Now, if you don't like the idea, if you think that would be offsetting to the participants, that gateways and redemption fees can be imposed during times of stress, and somewhat without notice. I mean, people could be caught off guard. Then what you're really left with is a government money market fund, which will not be subject to either gateways or redemption fees. In other words, a government money market fund will, in fact, allow a dollar, you still have the dollar value and you would not have to have gateways and redemption fees. So that's just a real quick introduction to issues you're going to be dealing with in the future. Brad, we have about a minute or two for either the guidance on the guaranteed benefits or the GAO report on managed accounts. Which one would you like to talk about?
We can talk about the GAO report on managed accounts because, it's interesting. It was a report that was requested by Mr. Miller originally, and it's done nothing to change my generally low opinion of the GAO's report quality. But what they did is they looked at about 8 providers of managed accounts to see how these were being used in plans, either as QDIAs or as opt-in options. And they raised a number of concerns, some of which, frankly, didn't make a lot of sense, but others of which have some validity, I think. And one of the issues they raised were the disclosure requirements around these. How do you go about, as a fiduciary, evaluating how to select a managed fund provider, and do you get enough information to do that with, and also do participants get enough information? So one of the issues that GAO had concerns about is that if you have a designated investment manager, that manager doesn't have to provide the same kind of disclosures as would a designated investment option in a plan. So in other words, you don't get the track history and the lengthy, all the additional information about that manager as you would for an investment. They also raised some concerns about the fiduciary status of these investment managers, and they seem to draw a distinction between 338 investment managers and a structure where the investment manager might actually be a 321 by virtue of how they structured the arrangement. And they sort of expressed concerns about that to DOL, and DOL responded by basically saying that they didn't perceive that to be a problem, but they would take into account what GAO said and look at that in context. The other issue, and I thought this was particularly interesting, GAO raised the question of whether there are conflicts of interest in designated investment managers as participants get near retirement, because the investment managers would have an incentive to keep those participants in the plan and therefore keep them paying fees to the investment manager, and therefore would that influence their advice over things like whether to roll over to an IRA or to another plan. What I found interesting about that, of course, is that's the opposite concern GAO raised in a different report on IRA accounts, where they were basically saying they're concerned that people have financial incentives to get participants to leave the plan, and seem to view that as the bigger issue. That was another issue they raised. And to that response, DOL said, well, we're looking at conflicts of interest generally in our rule on that, and that's something that we'll take a look at in the context of the fiduciary rule. So at the end of the day, I don't know that there's a whole lot in there. GAO also, of course, talked about higher fees, and it raised the age-old question of active management and whether the fees that are associated with active management are justified by the returns. And GAO's report, not too surprisingly, concluded that if the returns are higher than, enough higher than the fees, then yes, it justifies it. But if the manager doesn't beat, the other returns, then in fact participants come out behind because they're paying higher fees. I don't know, again, that there was anything new or interesting in that observation, but GAO used it to raise this question of, higher fees are always an issue to be worried about, and maybe managed accounts aren't the best way to go because they have higher fees. The industry data that GAO looked at tended to suggest that, in general, these managed accounts have returns that are somewhere on the order of 1.5% higher on an annual basis than participants who don't have managed accounts. The GAO was suggesting that in a case where that isn't true, you could still nonetheless have a worse outcome using a managed account. I don't know where they really go from these conclusions. I don't know that DOL really committed to doing anything different based on the GAO's recommendations, other than to say that they would look at the issues. But it was the first kind of comprehensive study that I've seen someone like the GAO do of this issue specifically.
Yeah, I think that there is going to be increasing attention focused on managed accounts. So if any of the folks listening in are advisors who are managing participant accounts, you may anticipate greater regulation in the future. One of the proposals was that there be a standardized way of calculating your performance or the performance of managed accounts. And another proposal was that each participant and plan sponsors be given a benchmark that their account will be managed against. So then participants, much like a mutual fund, would get a standardized method of reporting performance so they could see what the performance of their account had been, and then they would have a benchmark that they would compare that against. The objection I've heard from some investment managers, and believe me, the investment managers object to this report. This is very, very unpopular in the investment management community. But the objection I've heard is that some investment managers manage in an individualized style for each participant. And how do you have a benchmark for a highly individualized style? That's one of the issues that's coming up. Nonetheless, I think Brad hit the nail on the head. This is the first close look at managed accounts. There will be more to come, if for no other reason, just because that's how 401k plans work. As we get one issue resolved, we go on and look at the next one. And this now seems to be something that the government is looking at and is concerned about. Well, that brings us to the end of the formal presentation. Operator, we have time for a few questions. Why don't you open it up?
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please press star followed by the digit 1. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. A voice prompt on the phone will indicate when your line has been opened. Once again, star 1 to ask a question, and we'll pause for just a moment. And it appears there are no questions at this time.
Okay, well, thank you. We've pretty much used up our time and didn't allow much for questions in any event. So since there are no questions, let me turn it over to Jim Dolan to make an announcement of the next session and to wrap this up.
Certainly. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thank you, everyone, for calling in today and for participating. I want to thank Fred and Brad for a very insightful call today. And if you could, mark your calendars for March 31st. It will be our first call of next year. We'll be sending out an email in regards to the replay of this information as well as the calendar invite for the call on March 31st.
Elements to it as additional proposals. I think there's more to come on this because